You're listening to the Free Oromia podcast, dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. Thanks for tuning in to the Free Oromia podcast. Visit our website at freeoromia.org. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Team Free Oromia, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Team Free Oromia. You can also give us a call on the Free Oromia podcast hotline at 430-755-0727 and leave us a voicemail asking us questions or giving us your feedback. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Free Oromia podcast, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. My name is Jal Maro, and I am joined today by Jal Urga, back with us again. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
I feel like it's been a little bit since you've been on with us.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone is glad to have you back today. Unfortunately, Jal Ango is a little bit tied up. So, Jal Urga, thanks for filling in. So today we'd like to welcome to the show our colleague Henok Gabisa. Henok is the former president of the Oromo Studies Association, and he closely follows political and legal updates in Oromia and Ethiopia. Henok, welcome.
Thank you, Maratu and Urge, for having me.
Did you mean Jal Urga and Jal Maro?
That's exactly what I meant. I'm not trying to deny that.
Yes. So today we will be focusing on a new development on the war on Oromia and the Oromo people. We're going to be talking specifically about the presence of Eritrean troops in Oromia and the crimes against humanity that these troops are committing against Oromo civilians alongside the Ethiopian military and Amhara militias. Before we get into today's episode, please take a moment, listeners, to follow us on our social media. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter, both at Team Free Oromia. Please also visit our website, www.freeoromia.org, and take the Free Oromia survey. Okay. So let's go ahead and get into it. I'm sure a lot of people are probably wondering right off the bat how we know that Eritrean troops have indeed invaded Oromia. Can you give our listeners a little bit of insight into this?
Thank you, Jal Maro, for giving me this opportunity to come and share with you guys which I hope is the latest update and also some conversation about the most sensitive and important subject of freedom for the Oromo. I'd like to say it's my pleasure to be here. So, attending to your question about how do we know whether the Eritrean troops are present on the ground in Oromia, I understand that BBC Afan Oromo, which is the BBC Horn of Africa service, had the chance to talk to the people on the ground a few days ago, and they had reported that people, especially in Wulaga area, particularly in Horro Gudru area, verified that there are troops who speak Tigrinya. Now, when I was reading this news, one thing that I looked into is, at the moment, in the army, in the National Army of Bulsagina government, there is no one who speaks Tigrinya, because all the Tigray ethnicity armies and army members and generals had already left the army. And you just don't get to find anyone in the National Army of Abiy Ahmed who speaks Tigrinya. So the only available possibility is the troops from Eritrea, because they speak Tigrinya. That's one thing. And The second source of verification for this matter is the people themselves, the people of Oromo, who are going through a massive agony and vicious atrocity that had been perpetrated by the army of Abiy and the army of Isaias Afwerki, are the ones who can only attest to the problem and the information on the ground. So actually this statement is very consistent with what we heard in RC area a few months ago. We heard the same allegation of troops who speak Tigrinya at the same time involving in atrocious perpetration of human rights in RC area. And at that moment, I said to myself, we need to hear more about this. Now that the presence of Erchan troops is universally verified in Tigray area, and that there is international pressure on Abiy Ahmed and Isaias to withdraw the Erchan troops, they are further making a move down south in deep into Oromia. So these stories are very consistent, and the narratives and information that come out of the people of Oromo on the ground has its own organic verification. And on top of that, as I mentioned earlier, the BBC Horn of Africa reported on that. So that's the general source of authority on this issue.
Thank you. I'm glad that you mentioned that about that important clarification about the Tigrinya speakers from Tigray having left the Ethiopian military, because a lot of the information that is out there basically reports eyewitness accounts of civilians stating that there are what they believe to be Eritrean troops dressed in the uniforms of the Ethiopian military, but speaking Tigrinya. And so the reality is that we have to basically rely on these eyewitness accounts, because that's all that there is. As we know, the Ethiopian government, whether it's, you know, regional governments or the federal government, has repeatedly either refused to comment or denied all of the allegations. We saw the same thing happen in Tigray, where they repeatedly and blatantly denied that there were Eritrean troops in Tigray committing these atrocities. And of course, eventually the truth came out. It was abundantly clear. So we cannot ignore this evidence that we're seeing.
And one thing that can be the third source of veracity for this is the fact that the Ethiopian government, until very recently, did not even deny this allegation. And I guess about 3-4 days ago, the spokesperson from Oromia clearly denied about this allegation in a way that actually reaffirmed and reinforced the statement. So if we see the scale of evidence, the preponderance of evidence leans more towards the presence of Eritrean troops on the ground in Oromia. And the Oromo Liberation Front had also done its own verification process by capturing even the troops on the ground. And they have publicized the ID card of some of these troops. So I guess this is a general fact that has already been established now. The next question should be, I guess, what are the direct perpetrations of crime that they are really doing? I mean, that should have been the conversation.
Yeah.
Remember how many months it took the international community to establish the truth about the presence of Eritrean troops in Tigray, right? So I think there is a similar understanding here too.
Yeah, it just seems, particularly with eyewitness statements and eyewitness accounts, especially by the Oromo, it's a further dehumanizing of the Oromo to kind of delegitimize eyewitness accounts. And it's really interesting that like we've seen that pattern before, and what that actually means. I guess like it would be interesting to kind of unpack why Eritrean troops are invading Oromia, and what do you see as the function, or who are they actually fighting?
That's a huge question, Jal Urga. There can be multiple dimensions to this question. Obviously, Eritrea has a multi-dimensional goal, whether that's political goal, economic goal, or a social goal in Ethiopia in general. I would like to start with what are the possible economic rationale behind this, because we cannot understand the political equations behind this unless we try to unpack some of these political economic complexities involved in this issue. As we all are aware of the fact that Eritrea got independence from Ethiopia in 1993, there was a serious economic complexities that is left over between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Especially when the Ethiopian and Eritrean war started in 1998 and ended in 2000, in early 2000, most of the Eritrean investment had been nationalized. Some of them were expropriated, and the Eritreans were forced to leave Ethiopia without a due process or without a judicially approved process. And Isaias had been always keeping his eye out in Ethiopia to restore that economic gains that the Eritrean citizens or nationals left behind.
Yeah.
Especially in Finfinne area, there are a lot of Eritreans who do business or who used to do businesses and whose property were nationalized because of the war. Now, with this peace, much talked about peace between Eritrea and Ethiopia, which is not actually a peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea, it's a peace between Isaias and Abiy. It's a peace between two individuals, not a peace between the country. And so Isaias' main goal was to come back to Ethiopia and restore that economic hegemony in Finfinne. For that economic hegemony to be restored, there has to be a different access. There has to be a military access. There has to be an access that ensures that goal. So that's one possible explanation behind this. And the second is, what type of Ethiopia or Oromia does Isaias would love to see going forward? We know that the political destiny and the future fate of Eritrea in general, and particularly of Isaias, depends on how stable Oromia is. If Oromia is stable, which means if the demands of the Oromo people is being met, whether that's an independent Republic of Oromia or whether that's any other thing, the likelihood of Isaias finding a reason to insert his invisible hand in Ethiopia is very long. And that is not a good thing for Isaias. He always wanted a fragile, unstable kind of neighborhood country, a neighborhood that he can easily manipulate.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the goal. And that's a broader goal. But particularly, one thing that we have to also mention is about the the relationship between Oromo Liberation Front, which is the pioneer Oromo Party, and Isaias. For the last 20 years, OLF had its territorial base that had been given by Isaias in Erche. They were based in Asmara. The reason that Isaias gave them that favor, or the reason that he became a safe place for them, is because Isaias opposes anything Ethiopian. Isaias opposes and disagrees with anything TPLF. So OLF had been and is, again, opposing and hoping to deconstruct the Ethiopian state politics. So Isaias was giving OLF a place to stay, if you like, for that reason. Now that OLF had left Eritrea and independently engaging in Oromo politics on the territory of the Oromo, is something that Isaias does not want to see or does not want to deal with. Stable Oromia means a bad political trajectory for Isaias. So he had to be present in Oromia, and if possible, he had to make OLF dysfunctional, if you will. That's my analysis of why Isaias want to be there in Oromia. I don't personally believe that the Eritrean troops had a personal, purposeful, premeditated hate or military involvement against individual Oromo citizens, but there is a national political interest that they are after by being present on the ground in Oromia. So in the process of ensuring their interest, all kind of atrocities are happening. All kinds of human rights abuse are happening. But the biggest thing that we even have to bring our attention to is this is a clear invasion of a territory that is supposed to be sovereign, even under the framework of Ethiopia, right? So that's that. And the final point on this is the willingness from Abiy's part and the failure of the Ethiopian state had opened that opportunity for Isaias to send in his troops the way he wants. So stopping Isaias or Eritrean troops requires us first to deconstruct the Ethiopian state politics.
So it sounds like, as far as, I mean, obviously Oromia is not the only place where Eritrean troops have currently invaded within present day Ethiopia. But it sounds like, I guess what you're saying is that in Isaias's view, Oromia, the Oromo Nation, OLF, OLA, whatever you want to call it, has gone from being kind of a pawn to being an actual threat. Is that kind of what you would say? Is
not only an actual threat, but more like the honor of Oromia. I mean, remember, OLF had been relocated to Asmara after they were present, or after they were living in Somalia in early 2000s. And Isaias wanted to navigate the Oromo politics the way he wanted. The only available opportunity and territory for the OLF leadership to just go and remain or stay was only Asmara at that moment. Isaias wanted to make the Oromo politics dependent on him so that he would manipulate that in the interest of his own nation or state. Now that we know that Oromia is in a difficult political situation, but there is one biggest gain that Oromo and the Oromia had gained in the last 3 years. That is the Oromo political struggle is not happening in a neighborhood country. it's territorially based in the mainland of the Oromo. We might not have had our demands met, or we might not have, obviously we did not have the demands met, and we did not have main political questions answered, but there is one biggest thing that has been answered. The struggle is on the mainland Oromia by the Oromos, and this had saved the Oromo political struggle or the Oromo political camp from the chance of being compromised. When the oil left was in Eritrea, as long as they live, or as long as they are given that opportunity to remain in Asmara, they had to abide by some of the basic demand from Isaias. And that's the natural way of doing politics. Now it's in Oromia. There is no way to be compromised. And they can stand 100% in favor of the demand of the Oromo people. And that's the nightmare for Isaias. So it's not only them or Olef being a threat, a national threat to him, but he has lost control. So he wants to have a control back again. He wants to regain control. And that's not going to be happening.
Mm. Well, some would say, like, that's politics. Or, you know, one day your friend becomes your enemy. Some would view it as that for their own, obviously, political views. But I just want to, just pause on something for a minute. Like, you know, when you really think about it, the Eritrean troops being in, you know, current day Ethiopia and in Oromia is in and of itself such a significant thing for our listeners to think about and for the world to really understand. Eritrea is a foreign nation. What that actually means, what the actual invasion actually means. Can you talk a little bit about what that actually looks like in tangible sort of terms? On the ground, what does that, what does that mean on the ground, and what have been the consequences for the people?
Obviously, this is a crime of aggression. A crime of aggression is a well-established type of crime, international crime, along the line of genocide, crime against humanity, and war crime. These are the biggest atrocities in human history that had been given the legal recognition, whether that's in the Rome Statute, which is the International Criminal Court Treaty, or whether that had been recognized in the ICTY, which is the Yugoslav Tribunal, or the ICTR, that's the Rwanda Criminal Tribunal, International Criminal Tribunal. So these crimes had been recognized as international crimes. And recently, the crime of aggression, which had not been equally recognized along genocide, crime against humanity, and war crime, had received a full-fledged recognition by the United Nations in 2018 and 2019. For many years in the past, the crime of aggression had not been functional, obviously because of what President Bush had been doing in Iraq, and since the U.S. legal system had been universally and internationally influential, they just wanted to make crime of aggression dysfunctional. But now, since there is more or less a fair amount of peace between U.S. and some Middle Eastern countries, the U.S. is okay with the crime of aggression becoming functional again. So within that philosophy of crime of aggression, we are witnessing the same type of crime unfolding in front of our eyes in a poor emerging country such as Ethiopia. So that's the legal point of the legal aspect of what Isaias is doing. And a crime of aggression is a crime against another foreign country when another state invades without invitation or without consent of that state and affect the territorial integrity and the political unity of a country. What Isaias' troop are doing in Oromia is obviously challenging the territorial integrity of Oromia as the nation of Oromo within the Ethiopian framework, and broad in a broader sense, they are invading the territorial integrity of Ethiopia. So that's, I guess, one aspect of this. And the other thing is, besides aggression, the type of atrocity that they're involved in on the ground in Oromia is, as we read from the BBC report, BBC Afan Oromo report, they are engaged in killing, sexual violence. We have already established about the sexual violence in Tigray and how revengeful and how purposeful the raping and sexual crimes are. It's not only a sexual gratification, it's also a political, there is also a political philosophy behind it. Because for Eritrea, this is a revenge moment, a revenge to what happened in 1998 and 2000. So they are also doing that revenge aggression in Oromia by involving in sexual crimes, sexual violence, and sexual assault. So that's how I guess we can understand their presence on the ground and what they're perpetrating. And all of these things added together would easily fit into the legal framework of international crime. But the question, though, or the challenge that we might face in this is, Abiy might play the role of vindicating Isaias. You guys remember how Abiy and them admitted the presence of Eritrea. And there is a legal question here. If a prime minister of a country admits and agrees to the presence of a foreign troop in his country, does that amount to a consent? If there is a consent, it's less likely to say that this is an aggression. But the question is not going to be about holding Isaias accountable. It's about holding Abiy accountable on a different legal basis. That's treason. There is no way a prime minister of a country betrays his own people, his own country, and agrees to a foreign invasion. That's called treason. It might not be a crime of aggression, but it obviously is a crime of treason. So now, at the end of the day, it all depends on how strong the people of Oromo and how strong the political institutions and the holistic struggle within the Oromo is to repel back and to use their own natural and customary right to defend themselves, because you don't need a constitution or you don't need a United Nations charter to exercise an inherent right to self-defense.
So can I just ask about what you just mentioned? So do you see Abiy's sort of admission as a Freudian slip, or do you see it as a strategic kind of, I don't know, admission or like little window to kind of imply some level of consent or collaboration? Because that's a very, you know, when that speech sort of came out and there was news around that, you know, I think a lot of people saw it as kind of, you know, like fumbling and kind of, an admission without actually, like, you know, him wanting to maybe portray it in that way. So I think it's a very interesting. I don't think I've heard that, from that perspective before. So I'm just curious.
That's very interesting, actually, Galuga. You know, the main reason that Abiy decided to join this venture in the Horn of Africa is to create some kind of collaborative platform that can give him further resource in terms of strategic territories, because he had been, after the TPLF or he had been after the people of Tigray for many years when he came to power. So he had to use anyone, whether that's internal force or external force, who can stand against Tigray, who can stand against Abiy's own adversary. For Abiy, who are adversaries? The people of Tigray, who believe TPLF is their own legitimate government, are number one adversary of Abiy. Number two, the people of Oromo, who stand their ground to realize their right to self-determination and to realize their right to self-governance, are adversary number one of Abiy. He has clearly mentioned this when he came to power in 2018 and late 2019, when he went to Bahrdar and said, any force or any group, whether that's a social force or a political force, who has a nationalism ideology, are the enemy of the country, are the enemy of the state. So anyone who struggles or who on a daily basis struggle for self-determination and self-administration are the enemy of the state. So Abiy has to use, whether that's a foreign force, that's SIS, or the internal force, against those group he sees as the enemy of the state. So I think this is strategic collaboration for Abiy. It's not like Abiy has a particularly essential or intrinsic political gain from this. Whoever is directly or indirectly helpful to Abiy would remain part of the collaborative force or the force of the willing. That's one explanation. And there is also the other side of the coin, especially in Ethiopia. Look at the public faces and the public figures who Abiy is using as his wing or as his hitman, are people who, even within the Oromo politics itself, let's just be honest here. When he arrests Jawar, let's take this as an example. He uses people who have been working with Jawar in the past and who had been dissatisfied or who had some kind of dissent against Jawar. So he invites them, Abiy invites those to his wing, and he uses them against Jawar. And who is he working with when he wants to hit OLF? People who had dissents in OLF, whether that was in Eritrea or here in the diaspora or anywhere. So he is remobilizing the dissenting groups within the OLF or within the world of activists, and he is putting some kind of shape on them, some kind of political shape, and create them into some kind of hitman force so that he would, you know, he would do all those things. That's exactly what's happening. So the same thing is true when it comes to the foreign invasion. So if he wants to hit Tigray or TPLF, he wants to use the eternal enemy of the Tigray people. That's Eritrea.
Yeah, that's very interesting that, you know, that pattern in terms of, I guess, Abiy's actions. It sounds like he's using the enemy of my enemy is my friend type of approach. At this point, specifically talking about the Eritrean troops in Oromia, for example, or just in general, the Eritrean troops throughout Ethiopia, do you think that he's in over his head? Do you think he regrets it at this point?
Who, Abiy?
Yeah.
Well, Abiy is not the type of person who regrets.
Right.
From what we know.
right.
Abiy is, if we have to say a few words about this guy, he's a very dangerous man because he's a guy who had overcome his human fear. He has a certain political agenda in the Horn of Africa. He doesn't want to be the only, the biggest guy in Ethiopia only. He just wanted to be the biggest guy in the Horn of Africa, who reintegrated the Horn of Africa, right? So he's a dead man walking. When I say a dead man walking, a guy who has no kind of fear, he just had one goal and one goal only, to just make his political ideology meet the distinction that he wants to. And for that, there is no regret in this kind of psychological orientation. He doesn't regret. He doesn't even reflect on some of his moves, if you see. So that's why exactly this guy is a dangerous guy. And he doesn't... he doesn't care if he is caught red-handed when he's lying. He doesn't even care to justify some of the lies. You know, I mean, we know that all politicians do lie, but they lie in a very consistent manner, right? That's what politics is. It's a consistent, generally, I mean, you know. But Abiy does not even care when he's caught red-handed. He admits everything. And he's like, then what? Let's move on to the next one. That's who Abiy is.
He's the ultimate narcissist, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with you guys on that. So, you know, Henok, you mentioned earlier about the Oromo people's right to self-defense. So just, you know, taking a step back a little bit, Wabo, Warana Bilisuma Oromo, or OLA, the Oromo Liberation Army, is engaging in a liberation struggle for the Oromo people against Ethiopian state terrorism. A large part of that right now is self-defense, given the ongoing war on Oromia. So OLA, or Wabo, is engaged in this struggle to defend the Oromo people from the very kind of state and armed group violence which we have been discussing in this episode. We know that in addition to Eritrean troops, there are Amhara militias, also known as Fano, as well as the Ethiopian National Defense Force, or ABI's troops, waging war against Oromo civilians. And, you know, from the ABI perspective, this is in the name of defeating Shene, which they've labeled a terrorist group. So why do you think that all of these three foreign forces, the Amhara militias or Fano, Isaias's troops, and Abi's troops, have all descended on Oromia to engage in war against civilians? And are they all acting in the same way? Or are there different manners in which these entities are acting and committing crimes against Oromo civilians?
This is a very interesting question, to be honest. The reason it's very interesting is these three forces that you mentioned, Abiy's troop or Abiy's army, Isaias' troops, and the militia, the Amhara militias, do have sometimes, maybe in most cases, a mutually exclusive goal, political goal or military goal. And what unites them at this point is the entity or the group that they see as adversary to their short-term interest. But once they go past that adversary, who they see as adversary, they are extremely likely to turn against each other. And there is no question for that. And we can prove this. If you see the Amhara militia, what do they want out of this engagement? What is it that they want to bring back, or what is it that they want to achieve? It's simple and plain. They want to resurrect or restore the monarchical Ethiopia, or the type of Ethiopia that's based on the vision of single culture, single historical narratives, and single national identity. That's absolutely impossible in Ethiopia. Ethiopia is just, as some people call, a prison of nations and nationalities. where we have different language, different identities, and different type of many things, right? So the type of Ethiopia that Amara Militia or the Amara Force want to restore had been tried for the last 140, 250 years. Ever since Ethiopia was created in 1880s, up until today, there had been a national struggle. There had been a national difficulty that had never worked. So what makes them to believe that this is going to work this time again? It's not. So that's the goal of the Amara Militia. And in fact, Isaias fought in 1950s, 60s, and 70s and 80s against that very vision that he is standing along right now, the vision of the Amara Militia. So the very independence of Eritrea gained momentum in late 80s and early 90s because of the atrocity that the Derg regime was perpetrating against Eritrea. And the Amara Militia today are the replica of the same military or the same army force that had been witnessed during the Derg regime. So it's the enemy or the adversary that's uniting these forces at the moment. That's one thing. The other thing is, and even this Amara Militia at the moment do envision to return Eritrea back into Ethiopia, which is a big no-no in the mind of many all Eritreans and even in the mind of Isaias. So what's unite the hate that they have for their adversary is even sometimes higher than the political goal that they have in life. And that really bothers me a lot. So that's one thing. And what does the guy called Abiy want out of this? I don't believe Abiy has a national political agenda. Abiy has primarily a personal power agenda. Mm. And whoever achieves that, that's fine for Abiy. He can align himself. And so whether Isaias is relevant to him or Amara Militia is relevant to him, Abiy can always create some kind of partnership with them. And that's who Abiy is, and that's what he's doing exactly. But the problem, though, is at some point when these goals become apparently mutually exclusive and there is no meritful way to get out of this, that's when the real war and the real conflict happens. And for many months now, I have been expecting some sort of armed conflict between Abiy's force and some of these three forces that you mentioned, some of the forces that you mentioned earlier. And it's very likely going forward that we might see Abiy throwing under the bus some of these forces. They had already started doing that. So that partnership and collaboration obviously is there to disrupt, and it's very volatile, and it's going to be the biggest source of insecurity in that region.
Mm-hmm. At this moment, is it your understanding that they're acting in unison, or are they, you know, on the ground? Is it completely different approaches and tactics that they're using against civilians?
I do not believe that there is a well-organized, strategically arranged center of command for all of this. Most of these things are very spontaneous, but they have a meeting of mind. What do I mean by a meeting of mind? They know their short-term goals, and they are aware and very mindful of how that aligns with each other, and that's how they are acting. And I don't see a unified arrangement going on in here. And in fact, Abiy had, from what I read and from what I see, Abiy might have reached a stage where the Amara Militia is becoming more of a liability to him than being an asset, especially when it comes to Tigray. Abiy really wanted to have the Amara Militia during the first phase or the second phase of the war in Tigray. And now that the war in Tigray had turned to be more of a guerrilla fight or a guerrilla war, and Abiy can the way the Amhara militias are behaving in the western territory of Tigray is actually harming Abiy than helping him. So this would evolve into some kind of material friction or material conflict. And how can that be observed within the PP, Bilsagnaw, Oromo Bilsagnaw, or Amhara Bilsagnaw? All those political skirmish that we see emerge from those kind of things. At some point, when this turns into some kind of armed conflict, that's going to be another big revelation. But in general, the lesson from this is there is no competent leadership. There is no one interested in the stability of any territory that they're ruling. So the best course of action for anyone is to make sure that they represent the best interest of the people that they claim to interest anywhere. So if Oromia had been struggling for self-determination for the last 40, 50 years, the only solution is going ahead and realizing those things so that all nations and nationalities would secure their political destiny. And if at some point in the future, there has to be some kind of social contract or political contract, that can happen in any future settlement.
So just sort of reflecting on what you've just said, like Abiy's camp have a by any means necessary approach with a vision to retain power being his, like, you know, I guess, vision. So, you know, like what you've described is that all of these different groups have their own, essentially their own agenda. What do you think each of these groups are trying to accomplish by sort of invading and terrorizing the Oromo people within Oromia? And because I'm just trying to also sort of, you know, try and unpack where then we see the interests of these three entities colliding, because it sounds like we all have a sort of a basic understanding about what has brought them together in terms of trying to destabilize Oromia and what that means for their own political agendas. But what are they each maybe trying to accomplish that's different from one another? And where do you see those groups kind of, you know, where are their goals not then aligning?
That's very interesting, Jal Urge. At the outset of this discussion, I mentioned about the economic rationale behind most of these complexities. For Isaias, if you guys remember 2-3 years ago, how Isaias was frequently flying to different parts of Oromia, including to Jimma, including to Maki area, where there is a vast and massive agricultural activities. Jimma is the source of coffee for the Oromo. So at that point, they were fishing for some investment possibilities and chance. So Isaias particularly has, when it comes to Oromia, an economic interest that he wants to fulfill. For that to happen, his military occupation or his military presence on the ground is necessary. Just like in any other country, military occupation is a harbinger of the economic occupation.
Right.
That's what Isaias is doing. Besides the interest that he wants to have a weaker or a weakest territories in his neighborhood. That includes Oromia, Oromo, and the entire broader Ethiopian territory. For the Amhara militia, things are very ideological. Economic rationales are secondary to them. The Amhara militias, or the Amhara militia, had always idealized or perceived that the Oromo national struggle is the biggest threat to the state of Ethiopia, the state that they built and the state that they continue to build in their own favor, in their own likings. So that the Oromo national struggle had got to the stage that it cannot be reverted back, and the symbolical figure or the entity that owns this national struggle is Oromo Liberation Front, whether that's OFC or any other Oromo political parties, as long as they believe in the national ownership of the Oromo, of the Oromo land, everybody is Oromo Liberation Front. That we've been saying about this. So they wanted to make sure that this psychology, this Oromo consciousness, would be eradicated for once and all. That's a very naive way of perceiving, actually. They do not know that this is a psychologically integrated way of life for the Oromo. They feel like that there is a separate entity outside of the Oromo who owns the Oromo consciousness, or who owns the Oromo national struggle. That's OLF. So they want to fight OLF. They do not know that OLF is an Oromo mentality. Mm-hmm. It's an Oromo consciousness. Unless you kill all 50 million Oromos, you cannot get rid of that. Mm-hmm. So that's what they want to do in Oromo. You guys remember when the war against Tigray started, they were saying, oh, once we're done with Tigray, we're coming back to Oromia now. Right? So that's their goal. And the economic interest and things like that, that would come second or third for the Amara militias, to be honest. And of course, there is the Rist Asmalash, which is the land retaking. The Amara militia believes that all the land, including Finfinne, which they call Barara, belongs to their ancestral land. They claim deep into Wollego.
Sorry. Like, I just can't. I just need a minute on that one.
When you don't like your own stuff, so you got to take other people's.
That's classic. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, so they just go deep into many parts of the Oromia to claim the land of the Oromo. So they just want to restore that in their mind, but there's nothing to be restored. You cannot restore what you never had.
Boom.
Right. Busted. Right. Say it louder for the people at the back, please.
You just cannot restore what you never had.
Exactly. Yeah.
Facts. You know, so earlier when I was asking about Avi, you know, do you think he regrets it? He might not regret it, but maybe he should, because it sounds like certainly with all of these, you know, competing and conflicting interests, there's going to be a breaking point. And when push comes to shove, I don't know that, you know, he's going to be able to hold his ground. It sounds like he's on very thin ice.
We've been waiting for the day or the time that Abi would, you know, do some kind of arrangements, new arrangements to save himself. But that's what a rational human being does. Like, a rational human being regrets. A rational human being tries to do something different to help themselves, but that's not who Abi is. Abi's state of mind actually has to be researched. That's a different type of creature. So that's why I would say we're discussing here with some kind of rational thinking. What is it that they want, right? So I don't think that can be the most appropriate framework of epistemology to understand what's in the mind of these people. Mm-hmm. And that's how I understand Abi. Yeah. And let's just be honest, right? With all the faults and the problems, right, that Abi has been harboring, the first few honeymoon moments of Abi, like, people were willing to give him a chance. This is true, right? People were okay, whether that's Oromo, Amara, Tigray, from any direction, until we get to understand who the real person Abi is. Anyone, any politician who is interested in maintaining his or her own power you know, should capitalize on the existing kind of legitimacy. Why did he want to go this route? A rational person, a rational IB should have chosen to offend a less amount of forces or entities. But why did he do this? He did not have to do this. He could have continued the way he came to power. And that would have been actually very disastrous for us, for all of us, because we couldn't have detected who Abiy is. But now he unveiled himself. He revealed his true, authentic, organic human identity, or Abiy identity. And we're very grateful for that, actually.
Yeah, if only it hadn't happened in this way. But, you know, I mean, taking it back to a couple of years ago before things got anywhere near this catastrophic as they are right now, I mean, Oromos were calling him out. Oromos were saying that he was never, like, he did nothing to address the demands of Kero, who are the only reason that he even had the opportunity to be in power. And, you know, while it wasn't this brutal, I think some of the signs were there early on, which indicates that even in that state, he probably wouldn't have survived that long. It just would have looked a lot different. Now, you know, in some of the reports that we've seen about what's happening on the ground with Isaias's troops in Oromia, we've seen a lot of really horrifying violence on civilians. And there's been a lot of fighting with Ola as well, as Ola is trying to defend the citizens of Oromia. And in some cases, we've seen that when these forces are losing in these clashes with Wabo or Ola, that they then take revenge against civilians, right? So we saw one report very recently, a statement from the Oromo Liberation Front that when the troops of Isaias and Abiy lost, they then went out into the town and killed 3 women and a baby. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of really horrifying news like that. Where do you both of you, Henok and Jal Urga, where do you see this going? What's next for Oromia and the Oromo people?
Look, I think even though we're seeing like a continual escalation of violence and brutality, I also see the Oromo people becoming more resilient, more unified, and becoming more organized, despite how, you know, things might appear on the ground. I think politically, Oromos are becoming much clearer about the intentions of their enemies, their political enemies. I also think that there's been a complete, I want to say, like, a complete, maybe not silencing, but not recognizing of other nations and nationalities that have a vested interest in a multinational federation and the kind of force they can also become as Abiy and his allies continue to try and push a political agenda that throws not just the Oromo but other nations and nationalities essentially under the bus, and not really understanding the kind of impact that that's going to have on everyday people and how they respond to that. So I honestly think, like, you know, Oromos have historically been marginalized and been through so much. And despite how bleak things look and how just how tragic the situation currently is, we're never going to go back. We're always going to continue to move forward. And I think, you know, whether there are forces that are trying to exploit Oromia for its natural resources or for economic, you know, reasons, or whether it's to continue to try and, you know, assimilate the Oromo into this, you know, Ethiopianist movement that is not new, by the way, has been there for a long time, and Oromos have been able to, you know, really fight that off and continue to like solidify its Oromuma and what, you know, its culture is. I actually see Oromos becoming stronger. So I think it's a lot, like it's a hard road ahead, but yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with this upcoming, with this election that's happening. It'll be interesting to see how America continues their, like, you know, political kind of dialogue, or that lack thereof, with the regime. And yeah, that's sort of just like, yeah, some of the things that have been running through my mind, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think this is going to be a very honest and difficult conversation that we're going to be having. There are multiple in-house assignments that we need to work on. I've always personally believed that Oromos are headed in a very solid direction. Territorially, the place where the Oromo National Movement is happening is within Oromia, on the land of the Oromo, and that is the eternal truth, and that's what will remain. However, we have had enough amount of experience. And this chapter in Oromo movement life should not be the chapter where we still discuss about organization. By now, it's deeply ingrained and embedded in the blood and the mind of all Oromos that we need to just be a free type of people. People who are ready to self-determine or self-determine. There is no disparity on that. But when it comes to a formal appearance of how to formally negotiate, how to formally present, right, our national political struggle, there is fragmentation that we cannot hide. It's apparent, it's visible. And that had casted a shadow of doubt on the viability of how the Oromo force generally would behave in the Horn of Africa. So there is an in-house assignment that we need to really do. I mean, I'm not trying to undermine the achievements and the gains that we have, but at the same time, there are hard truths that we need to accept. And I would elaborate on this with some manifestation of how the organizational leadership and strategic leadership might be reveal itself. Let's say, for example, next door Somaliland can be one source of strategic alliance or experience that can work with the Oromo people. We've never made an attempt to, at least in the last 20 years or two decades, we've never made a richer program or an outreach program to them. There are different communities who are in the same kind of boat with the Oromo and who we never care to reach out to create some kind of alliance. I was just writing about this a few minutes ago. The Taiwan, the Tibet. And we know that Chinese government is heavily present in Africa, in Ethiopia, and in Oromia. And we know how the Chinese government is an economic enabler of dictators like Abiy. As long as dictators would serve the best economic interest of China, Chinese government is okay. So even for us to play within that power arrangement, creating strategic alliance with territories like Taiwan or Tibet would even further draw the interest of Chinese into their own politics. One thing that the government of China does not want to see in this universe is the prospect of Taiwan evolving into some more higher level of independence than who they are now. So the Oromo should have enough experience, especially in the circle of the Oromo leadership, to make some outreach or to have some outreach program. And that did not happen. That's something that this generation should continue, from what I understand. And that's the responsibility of all of us. The second thing that we have to look into is that for the Oromo national struggle to reach its destination, we need to, as Oromo, we need to make a public decision, a public announcement. What I mean by that is a nation or a society that's ready to make a decision is a society that can really achieve the right to self-determination. Self-determination starts from one's own mental liberation. Where do we stand individually? Where do we stand with that? When national self-determination that we speak is more of a formal thing, people first should find what is it that they want. As Oromo.
Listeners, think to yourself, what do you want?
Where do we stand? That's one thing. The other thing is, I want to explain about this, especially in the context of the people of the grind. In fact, it might be difficult to draw a parallel explanation because the number of population involved in this is very low in the Tigray context, called 6-7 million people, easy to manage, easy to mobilize, and easy to understand what people want. As opposed to 50 million or more, who do have different background contexts and so many social and political processes.
Very true, yeah.
So
we're a massive nation.
And
it's hard to have a unified voice of 50 million.
Right.
And recently, you know? That's absolutely true. And I wanted to buttress that. Recently, I came to a conclusion that the Oromo nation or the Oromo people are made to act like state, like a country that has its own internal,
its own different internal political opinions, that's different exactly. political parties.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is like a revelation for me. Like,
we have a robust society. Yeah.
So
we just need to get out of this predicament and then we can talk about that.
Exactly. this little situation. Yeah.
We need to have a common plan to get out so we can enjoy that robust society and have political debates and discussions.
And that's very true. And but I also have a public notice for international community. We know that the international community is taking what's happening in Tigray very seriously. And sometimes we do see reports here and there and how international community and actors perceive the Oromo Liberation Army and the Tigray Defense Force. Let's be clear on this. Oromo Liberation Army is what Tigray Defense Force is to Tigray people. Why did I mention this? There is a tendency within the international community to perceive and view these two different forces through a different lens. That's, in fact, the main problem that got us here from 1991. Had it not been for the fault line that had been created by the international diplomatic community during the transitional period in Ethiopia, Tigray would not have been in this situation today. If TPLF or the people of Tigray had made a lasting, perpetual strategic alliance with the Oromo people and the political party of the Oromo people, which is OLF, in early 1990s, probably Tigray is not going through what's going today. If OLF had the chance to govern Oromia, number one, the chance of having Oromo protest is very low. And if Oromo protest did not happen, we probably might not have Abiy, who rode the back of the Oromo youth, came to power, deceived the entire world, and killed the people of Oromo and Tigray. So the international community should not repeat the same strategic failure and the same strategic problem that they were part of during the transitional period in Ethiopia in early 1990s. So my notice is, or my note is, if Tigray Defense Force is defending the interest of Tigray, that's what Oromo Liberation Army is set out to do. And that's my belief, and that's my opinion as well. So trying to see OLA as some kind of force that had to be dealt with in a different political lens, as opposed to dealing with Tigray Defense Force with a different kind of lens, political lens, is really and seriously part of the problem. It does not help the people of Tigray. It does not help the people of Oromia. It does not help the Horn of Africa.
Yeah. Lots to think about, I think, for our listeners. I think this discussion has been very, very interesting. I've learned a lot and reflected on a lot of things. And I think that obviously the only hope right now on the ground for the people of Oromia is the Oromo Liberation Army. So thank you both so much for being on today. I hope that our listeners enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Thank you, Henok, for joining us today. Jal Urga, it was fantastic to have you back on as always. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Again, you've been listening to the Free Oromia podcast, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. We hope that you enjoyed our conversation today, and we'd love for you to take part. We want to hear from you. Call us and leave us a message on the Free Oromia podcast hotline at +1-755-0727. Tell us what you thought about our conversation today. You can also send us a message on Instagram or Twitter at Team Free Oromia. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thanks, Jalmiro.
Thank you, Jalmiro, and thank you, Jalurga, for inviting me.
Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye. Mi me kakhine ya tchisi sefundo fobonto.
నగమచేసి హాల్కను గల్గల నజల చేసి తంజోళ్ళు మాసన్ నదవచేసి ఓ రోమియో.